This is Live at Politics and Prose, a program from Slate and Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C., featuring some of today's best writers and top thinkers.
Author John A. Farrell is the author of three books, including tonight's book. He's also written Clarence Darrow, Attorney for the Damned, which won the Los Angeles Times Book Prize for Biography, and Tip O'Neill and the Democratic Century. He was also a part of the celebrated Spotlight team on the Boston Globe. Also relevant to this evening, he recently discovered a memo written by H.R. Bob Haldeman confirming Nixon's authorized attempts to throw a monkey wrench into Lyndon Johnson's peace negotiations in Vietnam. On to tonight's book. Tonight's book strikes me as being both important and relevant. Important because a serious biography of Nixon is essential to place him in the proper context of Americans' history. Farrell's biography is both enlightening and maddening. It tracks the life of a man with a terrible childhood who was a tackling dummy for the football team, a man who had no pedigree or Ivy League education and earned all of his early achievements. He was considered to be the best poker player in the South Pacific. 6 years after that, he was vice president. 16 years after that, he was president. And yet, his was an intellectual mind that despised intellectuals, carried grudges, and trusted few people. This biography is relevant because we currently have a president who is almost as equally reviled and supported as tonight's subject was. And yet, despite some editorials and attackers' claims, Trump is not Nixon, and thankfully, Nixon was not Trump. Anyway, before this gets too prickly, let's turn it over to the expert. Will you please join me in welcoming John A. Farrell?
Hello. There's a lot of familiar faces here as I walked in. There's Boston Globe Jack, there's Biography Jack, there's Family Jack, University of Virginia Jack, Kensington Jack. I saw a few people from Kensington Jack. And there's even Robert E. Peary High School Jack here in the crowd. And I think there was a Superman episode where if the characters from one dimension were to get together with the characters of another dimension, the space-time continuum would implode. Or maybe that was the Seinfeld show where Relationship George couldn't meet Coffee Shop George and Independent George because, like Kramer said, nothing good can come of this, Jerry. Poof. So we have to tread cautiously here. After this is over, please stay in your assigned groups. I don't want anybody from, you know, UVA Jack learning what a dweeb I was from the high school Jack guys and such. I'm a little nervous. This is the first time I'm presenting on this book and this book tour. It's a great thrill, as always, to be at Politics and Prose, which is truly one of the country's greatest independent bookstores. And the way that the very concept of truth is under attack in the country now, places like this are more important than ever. And Alyssa and Brad are really to be honored for their work here at the store, as well as the staff. I spent much of the last 5 years shuttling back and forth between an extended stay motel in Yorba Linda, California, and the nearby Nixon Presidential Library. And it's a very solitary life. It wasn't totally without human contact, because if you've ever stayed at an extended stay, you know that it's a mixture of people who are coming for a week or for two. So you get salesmen, you get roadies and musicians. In Yorba Linda, you get folks who are working on the sets at Disneyland. You get construction crews coming in for a project. And on several occasions, Orange County used this extended stay as an overflow housing site for the homeless. So you'd come down in the morning to get your coffee, and there'd be folks walking around, grinning, saying hi to each other in their bathrobes without having put their teeth in. And then you'd sit down with the musicians and the salesmen and the homeless guy, and you'd eat your little Fruit Loops out of the plastic bowls that they give you, and you'd talk about worlds colliding. But it's generally a solitary life, and no more so than at this particular archive, the Nixon Presidential Library. I developed a theory that presidential libraries take on the character of their president or vice versa. If you go to the Roosevelt Library in Hyde Park, it's this beautiful shingled dormered house on the banks of the Hudson in Hyde River. And if you go to Austin, to the Lyndon Baines Johnson presidential library, it's this gigantic, massive building built for scale, laying claim to greatness down there in Texas, where everything was big. Everything was big about Lyndon Johnson. His ears were big. His head was big. He was a big, tall man. His ambitions were big. His hands were big, and and his reproductive equipment he called Jumbo. Remember those innocent days when it was shocking to talk about whether or not Bill Clinton wore boxers or briefs? Well, now with the President of the United States, we've gone on to further intimacies. But I digress. The JFK Library in Boston is on Columbia Point, facing the Atlantic. The architecture is inspired by a sailboat, and on the grounds is actually JFK's old sailboat. And the Reagan Library is on, of course, it's on a Southern California mountaintop, and you can look out through the windows as you do your work and just sort of gaze at the Pacific miles away, all sunshine and light, just like Ronald Reagan. But the Nixon Library. The Nixon Library is stuck in the sprawl and the strip malls of Orange County. And you enter through the back door of the gift and curio shop to where a uniformed guard uses a key to operate the elevator and let you down into the basement vault. There you face a camera and you push a button and you hope that the attendant lets you in. And you enter a bunker of a room lit by fluorescent overhead lights. No ocean, no vistas, no sailboat, no windows, no views. The dominant feature is a wall of tape recording machines. Where people come to sit, put on their earphones, and listen to Nixon and Kissinger and hold them in for 10 to 5 p.m. every day. So I'm liberated from all that now, and the book is out, and the timing is, if at the least, fortuitous. It's published at a time where we have a break-in at DNC headquarters, hundreds of thousands of people marching in protest in the streets of Washington, an attorney general resigning over principles, allegations of wiretapping, and a war declared upon the press, all in the first 100 days. As one of my friends from UVA said, we're reliving the Nixon years as speed dating. And I'm sure we are providing great entertainment to Richard Nixon there in his perch in the afterlife. He's probably looking up at us and saying, you see, Bob, I was right. They'll miss me when I'm gone. Trump world is like, I was in New York and people asked me to try to describe what Washington was like. And the only analogy I could come up with was duck soup, where Groucho Marx played Rufus T. Firefly, the president of Fredonia, and walked around saying, if you think this country is bad off now, just wait till I get through with it. Or as Groucho said to one of the members of the Fredonia Congress, I'm sorry I said that. It isn't fair to the rest of the baboons. So Mark Twain is reported to have said that history doesn't repeat itself, but sometimes it rhymes. So the big question I'm sure that you're trying to ask answer for yourselves is why Nixon and why Nixon now? First reason is we're approaching the 50th anniversary of 1968. That most amazing year when Nixon got elected. And you think of my book as sort of a precursor of what you're going to see in the media for the next 2 years. Next week, in fact, April 4th, is the 50th anniversary, believe it or not, of Martin Luther King taking a stand in opposition to the Vietnam War. And in September, it's the 50th anniversary of the self-destruction of George Romney, who was Mitt's dad, who was leading Nixon in the polls when he returned from a fact-finding visit to Vietnam, and announced that he had adjusted his position on the war because he had previously been brainwashed by the generals at the Pentagon whom he was trying to persuade Americans he was smart enough to lead. At which point Eugene McCarthy is said to have said, brainwashed, a light rinse would have been sufficient. This is the history that we're missing that I try to bring to each one of my presentations. But then the year turned, and in very quick succession we saw Nixon entered the race, the Tet Offensive, Cronkite declaring the war was lost, McCarthy almost beating LBJ in New Hampshire, Robert Kennedy entering the race, Johnson dropping out, Martin Luther King assassinated, RFK assassinated, George Wallace running as a third party, the bloody riots at the Democratic Convention in Chicago, and Nixon's successful law and order campaign. So it's a big year next year, and I'm happy to provide a little bit of the history for that in preparation for it. But that's for that's mainly for people like myself who lived through some of that time. Two-thirds of Americans were not alive or living in this country when Nixon resigned in 1974. They have no memory of these events, nor of Nixon or of Watergate. The millennials are now the biggest generation. And I wrote this book for them and for the Generation Xers, not to take one side of the baby boom culture war from the 60s. Why do you write a book? You write a book for commercial reasons. The millennials hopefully will buy it. But also there's this impulse of an old guy to say, gather around, children, and you shall hear about this guy, Richard Nixon. For them, Nixon is still a caricature, someone they've laughed at in the Simpsons movie or booed as the villain in the X-Men movie. But they're interested. I've been to a couple of college campuses. They're curious. And especially in this time of Trump, they're very interested about this guy in Watergate. And thirdly, there's a lot of news to report. There are some 3,700 hours of White House tapes, and they finally finished the first culling of those tapes in 2013. And they're about to go through them all over again because all the snippets that they left out for privacy reasons, there's been a whole round of deaths, and now they can release those as well. So for the rest of our lives and probably for another 20 years, there's still going to be Nixon tape recordings coming out. And Stephen Ambrose, who wrote the three-volume biography of Nixon, didn't have access to all but maybe a dozen or two of those tapes that were used in the Watergate trials. They've all now become available. They give somebody like a biographer an unbelievable perch. This last summer, I went and saw Hamilton up in New York, and as I was sitting there, I was thinking, like, boy, you know, if there'd been a tape recorder in the room where it happens, then we would really know everything that Hamilton said to Jefferson and everything that Jefferson said to Madison. But we can actually do that with Nixon. We can actually portray his thoughts and his feelings at many of the crises of his presidency. And then in 2012, Whittier College was going through their basement, and they came up with 400 oral histories of Nixon's childhood friends, his parents, his relatives, aunts and uncles, classmates and neighbors. And they provided just this incredibly rich way to retell the story of Dick's childhood. And then finally in 2007, the National Archives opened up Nixon's political files, which he had spent $1 million on legal fees and fought to keep secret while he was alive. And so now those were available as well. You may have seen it was referred to that in January I did a piece for the New York Times about how Nixon interfered in the peace process in 1968 to advance his own presidential ambitions. There's also an awful lot of amazingly rich material about Nixon's Southern strategy, which led in turn to the topsy-turviness of American politics, where the solid South is now solid again, but it's solidly Republican. There's one great excerpt in there, a memo from Bob Haldeman, his chief of staff, where there's a crisis at the Miami convention, and Ronald Reagan is threatening to take the nomination away from Nixon, and Nixon sends Haldeman to the Southern delegations with the promise that if they stick with Nixon during his years in office, he will cut out the pro-Negro crap. But the final answer, and the real reason that you're here, and the way I hope that you'll read the book, is that Nixon is such a classic story. The original working title for the book was Richard Nixon, An American Tragedy, because it is a tragic story. He had qualities that were really heroic. He raised himself by pure will and hard work from the nowhere's will of Yorba Linda, and a childhood that was tinted with poverty, the death of two of his beloved brothers, a father that bordered on the abusive, and a mother that would retreat into her closet to pray. And as Nixon famously said, she never told me she loved me in my life. So as one Washington colleague said, he went up the wall of life with his claws. He volunteered for service in World War II, and he continuously pushed the Navy until they assigned him to a combat zone. He came home like JFK and ran for office, part of a new generation offering itself as leaders. He had no famous family, no Ivy League education, no political machine. It's hard to exaggerate what a long shot he was. And within 6 years, he had gone from literally nothing to vice president of the United States. And after 8 years of turbulent service as Dwight Eisenhower's vice president, he went on to take on John Kennedy in the 1960 race. Well, Kennedy was his friend, believe it or not. They had made an attraction, and the Nixons were invited to Jack's wedding to Jackie. So the hurt and the anger were twice as intense when Nixon figured that the Kennedys had stolen the 1960 election. Julie Nixon Eisenhower helped me a little bit on the book. Tricia did not, Kissinger did not, but Julie was willing to say at one point that it was the experience of 1960, the belief that he had been cheated out of that election, that left Nixon with the grim resolve of never going to be out-cheated again. And there's a wonderful story I didn't put in the book of a Secret Service agent walking down the aisle of the airplane during the campaign, and Nixon sitting there by himself, not knowing he was being watched, pounding the armrest of his chair in the airplane, saying, "Gotta be tougher, gotta be tougher, gotta be tougher." And that's the kind of drive that he had, always persuaded that there somewhere there was somebody handsomer, richer, better connected, Ivy League educated, who was going to take his achievement away from him at the end. And of course, there was the liberal press. It was his nature to lash out at them, and it was their nature to like the Roosevelt's New Deal, Adlai Stevenson, and John Kennedy. The coverage, as I went back and looked through the 1950s especially, was, if you remember how Fox News covered Barack Obama, that's how the press covered Richard Nixon in the 1950s and 1960s. Huge, huge tall tales, many of the caliber of, not quite approaching the caliber of birtherism. And I had to trace all these down. One example is the poker story, the shorthand for Nixon's World War II experience, which was very important for that post-war generation of voters, was that, oh, Nixon stayed in Philadelphia and played poker through the war, and he made a lot of money playing poker while Jack Kennedy was out there on PT-109. And it wasn't true. Nixon was actually at the next island over from Jack Kennedy in the Solomons. And his job was to take the airplanes as they landed in a combat zone, take off the wounded, and fill the airplane with supplies, and send it up on hopping up to the next island. And his tent was destroyed by shell fire. So he had a real experience. And yet, if you go through the liberal press at that time, there's absolutely no reference to it, or very little reference to it at all. But Nixon had a way. He took that hatred and he honed it and he used it. And he had an unequal ability to tap the grievances in his audience. He felt in himself, and so he identified with voters, with people on class, on race, and just on base feelings like envy. And the great Democratic speechwriter of the time, Richard Goodwin, put it this way: Nixon could reach with uncanny intuition the buried doubts, the secret dreads, the nightmare panic of the threatened soul. And don't want to go too much into the Trump analogies now, because we'll probably get to them in the questions and answers, but that one certainly rang a bell with me when we had a presidential candidate talking about Hispanic judges and rapists coming across the border and barring all members of the Muslim faith. But here's his tragic flaw. As driven as he was, as bright as he was, he was really scarred by his childhood, had horrible feeling of self-worth. He was insecure. He was paranoid. He was driven. And any time he had a great success, one of the saddest moments of the tapes is after he comes back from China, and you listen to the tapes like 2 days later, and he's talking to Henry Kissinger. And Richard Nixon, his greatest accomplishment, he feels the need to ridicule and say, well, you know, all that shaking hands stuff doesn't make any difference. It's all, you know, the American people are a bunch of sheep. You know, they go for that peace crap. And yet, that's not where Richard Nixon really was. What he really wanted to do, his great goal from his sainted Quaker mother, was to provide 20 years, a generation of peace. And in fact, since not just because of Richard Nixon, but, you know, that approach to China was a great crack in the Cold War. And he did bring about a peace for probably a longer time than he thought he could. So he became Iago to his own Othello, always whispering in his own ear, saying, you're not good enough, this wasn't good enough, this didn't mean anything, they hate you, you're not worthy. And that mushroomed into a narcissistic feeling. he began to live in the presidency on the sensation of risk, to escape the pain of this self-examination. And he was sort of like a gambler who gets his thrills while the dice is in the air. Nixon loved that feeling of risk. And he didn't really recognize it until the very end, after Watergate had finally claimed him. And in what I think is one of the greatest moments of American political history, certainly one of the greatest televised moments, Nixon stands in the East Room of the White House and says goodbye to his staff. He talks about his father, who was a common man. He talks about his mother, who was a saint. And he says, "Always remember, others may hate you, but those who hate you don't win unless you hate yourself, and then you destroy yourself. Unless you hate them, and then you destroy yourself." So, why Nixon now? I've had some fun with Trump tonight, and I expect that we will have some more. But it's good, I think, to remember Nixon's parting words. Today's polarization, I'm going to preach now. Today's polarization is more than just a political phenomena. It really threatens, I think, in this 21st century world, the American ideal, even if we survive President Trump. For today, the ideal is this, that a self-governed people, varied in national origin, in faith, in the color of their skins, can still be that city on a hill that John Winthrop talked about on the ship Arbelaz, he and his fellow Puritans approached Massachusetts. And that new world beacon not only preaches to others about the virtues of liberty and equality, but it demonstrates to the world that even in nations as diverse as ours, that these values are achievable. There is hope. If we lose that battle in this country, with its wealth and its sturdy democratic institutions and our deep abiding beliefs and all the hard-won gains it has made in equality of race and gender or sexual orientation, then it's really difficult to see how other democracies can resist it as well. And historians love to quote Abraham Lincoln, and I was finally identified as a historian by the New York Times, so I'm going to quote Abraham Lincoln. In 1838, Abraham Lincoln said, "All the armies of Europe, Asia, and Africa combined, with all the treasure of the earth, with a Bonaparte for a commander, could not by force take a drink from the Ohio River or make a track on the Blue Ridge Mountains in a trial of 1,000 years. At what point, then, is the approach of danger to be expected?" And Lincoln answered, "If it ever reach us, it must spring up amongst us. It cannot come from abroad. If destruction be our lot, we must ourselves be its author and its finisher. As a nation of free men, we must live through all time or die by suicide." And if you think about it, that was the meaning of Barack Obama's Nobel Prize. He hadn't really done anything particularly wonderful to qualify for it except to win that election. But it was the world saying to us, "Bravo, keep it up. You inspire us. Keep being America. We were that people 8 years ago, and we can be that people again." It's reassuring and refreshing having toured college campuses and engaged in debate with my children's generation that these millennials have figured it out. Their values are good, they're fair and generous, and so our task in the immediate future is not to tear ourselves apart, not to die by suicide, as Lincoln said, not to succumb to hatred, because if you hate, as Richard Nixon told us, you destroy yourself. So, that's my story. So, any questions about Richard Nixon?
Thank you for an enlightening presentation.
Thank you.
I have a carton of Nixon watches with 5 o'clock shadow if anyone wants to buy. My question to you is this. Nixon passed or inspired to be passed lots of liberal or progressive legislation. Do you believe that he believed in these causes, or was it strictly political?
It was both. Nixon was, above all, an expedient politician. But he had that faith that the World War II generation had, which they had seen big government do amazing, wonderful things. They had seen big government take the auto plants of Detroit and turn them into tank factories and turn out as many airplanes in 1 year as Nazi Germany could make in 5 years. So they had much bigger faith and less fear of big government. And the other thing that everybody, that I think often escapes my conservative friends, is that in Nixon's lifetime, the population of the United States of America doubled. Now, that's a lot of new people, and that meant you had to have schools, you had to have highways, you had to protect the rivers, you had to somehow deal with all that new waste People were leaving the Rust Belt and beginning to move down to the South and the Southwest. So it was just a constant demand for government services that to that generation left them with a feeling that we really want government activism. Now, it was a Democratic Congress. You guys remember those days. That's why he was impeached, and that may be why Donald Trump never is impeached. But that Democratic Congress would put stuff on his desk, and he signed it. He signed. Senior citizens get cost of living increases these days because Richard Nixon signed that bill. Young women get scholarships for athletics because Richard Nixon, dragged kicking and screaming, signed that bill. He desegregated, under court order, the Southern schools. And in fact, several times in the book, I pause the narrative just to talk about Nixon and race, because it's such a glimpse into a politician's soul. And you see him go from an idealistic / expedient politician in the 50s to a more calculating one in 1960 when Martin Luther King is arrested and JFK and Bobby Kennedy send a word down to the judge in Georgia that he needs to be released, and the Nixon campaign says no comment. And then finally you see the Southern strategy in full bloom with its cynicism. But the phrase that I keep coming back to when I talk about Nixon is always "and yet." Because while he was doing the Southern strategy, "and yet," he was quietly and efficiently desegregating the Southern schools. So he's a complex guy. If you read the book, it's not a simple story, and it was something that I had to wrestle with.
I'm struck by the advantage that you and other Nixon historians have that other presidential historians don't, both before and since, and that's those tapes. I'm thinking of all that would have been lost if not for those tapes. So my question for you is, what can you suggest to subsequent historians who don't have that advantage to fill that gap, to answer those questions?
Yeah. I had a lot of debates about Hillary's emails with people because I'm a liberal Democrat and wanted her to win, and thought that on the surface it was a made-up issue that the press went crazy about to excess. And I still believe that to a great extent. But the most persuasive arguments that I got back from other people is they were saying, okay, fine, you're a former reporter, a former investigative reporter, and now you're a historian. And you're saying it's okay that she had a private server to hide all the good stuff? I hope, you know, there were stories that the Bush White House disposed of 60,000 emails that'll be priceless for historians. Nobody keeps tapes anymore. Nobody keeps diaries anymore. And very few people write candid memos anymore. So it could be that books like this books are going to perhaps slowly fade from the scene anyway, but that the ability to write a piercing look based on documents is going to leave us. And what you're going to get, and what makes somebody like Bob Woodward's work so valuable, are the constant interviewing of reporters. And, I've been down to the University of Texas to see the Woodard and Bernstein archives. I use them for the Watergate chapters. And they're just they're invaluable contributions because, you know, the Watergate year, all the president's men year, is incredibly sloppy. But at some point, a light went off in Bob Woodward's head, and he started typing everything, dates, taping everything. Irony that was, and left this amazing record about the later books that he wrote. And so I see Michael Cranish here, who's one of our great younger presidential historians. Mm-hmm. And I hope he's saving his interviews and sticking them in a vault somewhere, because we're not going to have these other resources.
Thank you.
Sure.
First of all, thank you for being here. It's always interesting to get another perspective on Richard Nixon. He's certainly a very complex individual. A recent book came out with respect to Dwight Eisenhower and President or General Eisenhower's relationship with Vice President Nixon. And let me read you a quote, which I found rather fascinating. And that is, the author suggests and implies that Eisenhower at one point said to Nixon, when Nixon was vice president, that potentially the best platform to which to run a successful presidential campaign might be something besides vice president, and in fact a cabinet post, might be a better launch pad. Nixon, of course, had that inner aspect about regarding, well, gee, does Ike want me off the ticket in some respects? My question to you is, and again, I put on your back to the future hat, so to speak, and that is, had Nixon chosen that course of action, that is something besides vice president, let's say Secretary of State, let's say Secretary of Commerce, would that have been a better launch pad, as this particular author expresses? And if so, do you see him potentially beating a Senator John Kennedy?
It would have made him a better president, because one thing that Nixon did not have was executive experience. The biggest office he ever ran was his congressional offices, and then what in those days was a very small vice presidential office. Eisenhower thought he was an okay alternative. He was always listed in like the top 10 potential successors if Ike should not run again for a second term, or if had to drop out because of health reasons. But Ike never put him at the top. And Nixon sensed this, and it worked on that feeling of insecurity. And Nixon's time as vice president was pure agony. But he was crafty Dick Nixon. And he saw ways, first of all, when Eisenhower had the heart attack, he was the perfect vice president. He was distinguished. He was reserved. Whenever he went to visit one of the cabinet members, he went to their offices rather than taking over the Oval Office and have them coming to him. And he got nothing but high marks from that, which really made it a shock when Ike got better again and called him in and said, hey, wouldn't you rather be in the cabinet? It wasn't that bad a choice. At that time, only one vice president had successfully risen to the presidency. It escapes me now. Without an assassination or a forced retirement. And yet, within the previous 20 years, there had been two cabinet members, Herbert Hoover and somebody else, who had become president of the United States. So it wasn't quite the slap. And they were talking about Secretary of Defense and Secretary of State. And it probably would have made him a different person and maybe a better person. But, you know, Nixon was this dreamer. And he didn't like, you know, bureaucratic details. He wouldn't have liked struggling over budgets for aircraft carriers and bombers. And by being vice president, he got a chance to go to Caracas and show that how brave he was when the mob of dozens attacked his car. or when he went to Moscow and had the famous kitchen debate with Khrushchev. And he very shrewdly made effective use of those. In the presidential campaign, I think it was all the first debate. If you look at that first debate, people talk about Nixon's makeup and how sick he was. He had just been getting over from an infection in his knee. But if you listen to JFK's closing remark, I mean, if you want to see why JFK won that election, 1 minute snippet at the end of the debate, and JFK looks in the camera and gives this little lyrical, poetical summation of his campaign themes, even with, like, you know, Shakespearean a Sorensenian twists. And then Nixon is still playing Whittier College debater. There's still two or three statistics that he has to try to squeeze in to show Jack that he's as smart as Jack, and he's convinced somehow that anybody in America really cares what the percentage of the Soviet GDP was as compared to 4 years ago. So, you know, I think that even as a long way of answering your question, even as a cabinet member, it wouldn't have prepared him for that coming together, that set of circumstances that made that first debate so fatal. There were many other reasons. I mean, he actually probably won. He probably won the popular vote. He probably won the electoral vote, or maybe he won the electoral vote. And so it wasn't, you know, sort of like Hillary Clinton. He ran a very good race. Nothing to be ashamed of from that race. I'm not sure that being a cabinet member would have made any difference.
Thank you.
Sure. Yes, sir.
Yes. So you sort of touched on the Southern strategy component of it, but I'm just curious, how much did Nixon's sort of antagonism towards the media and towards, you know, the quote-unquote academics lead to this development of the so-called Southern strategy, for which he has been pretty much, you know, a boogeyman, if you will?
Yeah.
I mean, he picks, you know, Spiro Agnew, for instance, who supported open housing. I mean...
Yeah. Oh, Nixon, and yet. So Nixon is convinced after 1960 that no matter what he does, he can't get black votes away from the Democratic Party because they're aligned with the party of Roosevelt over the New Deal social programs. And then Lyndon Johnson comes along in 1964 and 65, pushes the big civil rights bill. Richard Nixon supported every major civil rights bill, 57, 64, 65, open housing in 66. Unblemished record, almost unheard of in the Republican Party, which was beginning to turn towards the Goldwater right at the time. You can go back and read Theodore White's books, The Making of the President books, and he gives at that his analysis at that time is that Nixon bravely resisted the temptation to play race in the 68 campaign, and to a certain extent that is true because the Southern strategy was much more important in winning the nomination than it was to winning the general election. He won Florida, Tennessee, the border states, not the interior South, which went to George Wallace. And then he gets into office, and what he tells his people basically is, we'll do what the courts force us to do, because we have to, because it's right. But we're also we're going to do it in such a way that we don't get any credit for it, because we don't want the credit for it. We want the people down South to still think that we're on their side. And so he puts in these two, one very mediocre and one semi-mediocre Supreme Court nominees, makes a big dust-up about that, while at the same time he's very quietly meeting with delegations of black and white Southerners in the Oval Office and saying, look, you know, really exerting presidential leadership down to the community level. So is he the reason that the Republican Party turned right as hard as it did on race and gave up its roots in the civil rights movement? Probably not. Did he capitalize on that development? Yes. Did he further it? Probably. And getting back to your question about the press, is I think that the press, when it sums up and says Nixon's Southern strategy was the reason that the Republicans turned so hard right on race, is a simplistic way of saying, you know, the Democratic Party had bungled the issue of race. They had stuck with the solid South racists for 100 years, and when it came time to reform, they wouldn't do it. John Kennedy had to be pulled kicking and screaming to send the troops into the University of Mississippi. So and Nixon gets, I think, a little bit too much blame for that one. Yes, sir.
Some figures in history are known for having compartmentalized personalities and lives, with the result being that no one truly knew them as a whole person. Did anyone really know Richard Nixon as a whole person? And if so, who might that be?
Well, I think one of the great changes in my view that I came away from reading this book was about Pat Nixon. And also about the daughters, who in the 60s they were vilified as Plastic Pat and, you know, Prissy, Trisha, and, you know, Julie had such a bubbly personality that she sort of got a pass. But still, they were, you know, they were right-wing Nixon now girls, rather than blue-jeaned, buckskinned hippie gals. And so I didn't have, like, a really great feel for any of the three of them. And the one thing Trisha wouldn't talk to me, but the one thing that I came away with was this great respect for Pat. She hated politics. She hated politics from almost the beginning, almost the first race. And as soon as they got into politics, Nixon, who had this very chauvinistic opinion of women, he once said to his aide, Haldeman, we don't want Pat to be Eleanor Roosevelt, an activist first lady. But he began to push her out. You know, the first campaign, it was a spirited thing. They were going to be together. She was the gypsy lass, and Dick was the knight on the charger, and they were going to take down this evil Democrat. And from that point on, he slowly pushed her out and relegated her to the horrible role of candidate's wife. And time again, the torture that he went through put the family through torture. They had times when they, you know, broke apart without formally breaking apart. And yet, you know, somehow she hung all the way into the end. And if you look at the pictures of him at her funeral, it's hard not to just feel the agony that he felt, because this great comrade that he, you know, had loved. The feeling that you get from those people who love Richard Nixon and knew him is they have this, like, protective emotional feeling about him. that, as Henry Kissinger famously said, imagine if somebody had only loved him, what a great guy he would have been there. So they must have seen something in him. And the best interview I had was with his brother. He has one surviving brother, and I spent a day with his brother. And we talked about the family, but even more so, it was just so important to see the brother looks like him, has the same mannerisms, talked about the family, has the same sort of slouch, and really made me feel for what that childhood was like where Dick was being grown up. And he really was a shattered personality, and you can see why these people felt sorry for him and why Pat and the daughters stayed so loyal to him over the years.
Hi, I'm Kensington Jack. We have a president now who seems to be very enamored of military power, and if there's any situation where America might be embarrassed, we might get in another scrape. President Johnson knew that we couldn't win Vietnam, yet he didn't want to be the first one to lose a war and get out. Why did it take Nixon so long to get us out of Vietnam, and could you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. One theory is we go back to the 68 campaign, and at the end of the 68 campaign, Lyndon Johnson thought he had a possibility of a peace deal. And Nixon got word of it from Henry Kissinger and other sources and decided he was going to torpedo it. He was going to do what he could to scuttle it. And he sent one of his campaign aides, a lady named Anna Chenault, to talk to the South Vietnamese and to tell them to drag their feet. And they did, and Johnson's peace plan fell apart. And throughout this entire time, Johnson was picking up rumors about what was going on in the Nixon campaign. And so he started eavesdropping on the South Vietnamese embassy and on the palace in Saigon. And he actually heard Anna Chenault saying to the South Vietnamese, drag your feet. Our guy's going to win. Just hold on a little bit longer. So Nixon always denied it. He denied it on the Johnson tapes to Johnson. And you hear him, you can see him in the David Frost interviews denying it again. He's denied it to everybody who ever asked him, biographer or journalist in his life. And there I was paging through these files that he had fought so hard to keep all his life, and among them were this gathering that Bob Haldeman had put together of Haldeman's notes from that campaign, in which Nixon says, send Anna Chenault to the South Vietnamese, we're going to monkey wrench the peace talks. So for the first time I added that little piece which put it right in Nixon's mouth. Historians had known this was going on. The Johnson tapes came out, so we knew what Johnson felt about it. So Nixon wins, and now he has to decide what he's going to do about Vietnam. And the most learned Democratic foreign policy experts say that because President Tu in South Vietnam now had this hanging over Nixon, this scandal, that Nixon's options were dramatically limited from that day forward because...
That sounds familiar today.
Yes, it does. I have talked to several people about what Nixon could have done. And one thing he could have done, De Gaulle, he loved De Gaulle. He admired De Gaulle. And De Gaulle had ended the war in Algeria by just saying, it's over, we lost, we're going home. And then he'd worked out a withdrawal plan so that the Algerians who were loyal to France were evacuated and there wasn't that big bloodshed, which was the rationale for America not doing the same thing in Vietnam. And Nixon never even considered it, probably in part maybe because of the Tu thing or just because he was not going to be the president who lost a war, even though he could blame the whole thing on Johnson and Kennedy and say, I didn't really lose it. They did. And people say, well, you remember what the country was like then. Nobody wanted a complete defeat. Nobody wanted a complete withdrawal. And I said, you know, if we're going to give him credit for the vision of going to China, you know, he should have had the vision to say, you know, if I get out now, it's going to be a clean break. And if not, we're going to go through, you know, it's going to be 5-6 more years before Saigon falls. We're going to lose Cambodia. 2 million Cambodians are going to lose their lives. 1 million Vietnamese boat people are going to lose their lives. And 20,000 more Americans are going to die for a mistake. He didn't have the vision, the flexibility, or maybe the courage to do that. And so that's why I think that his handling of Vietnam, and especially the Chenault affair, that making that decision, are much more reprehensible conduct than the things that happened in Watergate. Yes, sir.
A few years ago, I had the honor and privilege of spending an afternoon with one of Nixon's aides when he was vice president, and then again as president, a retired Air Force officer. He was with Nixon during the attack in Venezuela or in South America, and naturally he was with him during 1960. I asked him what was his most memorable moment with Nixon. He talked about Election Day, 1960, about taking, I can say, you're smiling. I was going to ask you, did your research come across A,
that's right.
The thing about in 1958 and Election Day, 1960, which I think you're going to finish the story, what that guy told me.
Was it Don Hughes?
Yes.
Don's a great guy. He's still alive, I believe.
Yes, he's 94 years old.
He was with Nixon a lot, and there's several great Don Hughes stories. Nixon would have temper tantrums, and sometimes he would actually lash out and push or hit people. And he was driving through Iowa one day in one of the campaigns, and he was in the back seat of a car, and Hughes was in the passenger seat. And Nixon got so furious that they were driving mile and mile and mile, wasting all this time between stops when they could have taken a small plane or something, that like a little kid, you know, throwing a tantrum, he started kicking the front seat in front of him. And Hughes is sitting there going, ow, what are you doing? And he said, stop the car, stop the car. And Hughes gets out and starts walking down this road through the cornfields of Iowa because he's never going to work for Nixon again. But he did. And Nixon was, and Hughes was also the person who tells a lot of people, told a lot of stories about Nixon's susceptibility to drink. Nixon was not a big drinker, but he couldn't take more than two drinks. So Don was somebody who was put in charge of making sure that Dick got to bed at night. And there was actually one point in one of the campaigns where Nixon fell asleep leaning against the wall, and Don Hughes had to get him and tuck him in. And Nixon woke up and said, we're going to win because God is on our side. And then passed out. Which was the incident that you wanted to tell me? I lost it already. Senior moment.
Election Day, 1960.
Election Day, 1960, yeah. Right. So Nixon and Pat vote. Nixon says, see you, Pat, you know, go to the movies. And he gets in this convertible with Don Hughes and two other people. And they start driving down the coastal highway in Southern California, just breezing along, and you know they're pulling up to stoplights, and people in the car next to them are gaping because there's Dick Nixon, you know, riding along in a convertible, and Nixon says, "Let's go to Tijuana and have some Mexican food." So, they cross the border in Tijuana. They go to amazingly named Old German Restaurant or something like that in Tijuana. The mayor hears that they're there, so the mayor of Tijuana and like a band comes and they serenade Dick, and then they get back in the car and they drive back into the United States. And Don Hughes is Catholic, so they stop at the mission of San Juan Capistrano, and they light a candle, and then Nixon ends up going back to I guess it was the Ambassador Hotel in Los Angeles to get the results. But it was a great story of Nixon, you know, and I think the words he said to the driver was "lose them," meaning the press. Right. And so they went on this car chase throughout the streets of Whittier until they ducked the press off and headed off down to Tijuana.
Right.
How would you describe the relationship between Kissinger and Nixon, based on the research that you did?
Kissinger, the tapes ruin Kissinger the same way they ruin Nixon, because he comes across as so obsequious. Nixon will say stuff like, "I'm having Connolly come in," and Kissinger will say, "Oh, that's good, Mr. President," and Nixon will say, "You know, Connolly has this animal-like savagery." And Kissinger said, yes, savagery. And then Nixon would say, "I have that too." And Kissinger said, "Well, of course you do, Mr. President. Of course you do." And says, "But I've managed to control it and hone it." He says, "Yes, Mr. President, you've honed it. Yes, you have." And Kissinger never knew about the taping system, and neither did John Ehrlichman. And when the two of them heard about it, they were walking down a hall in the White House, and they said to each other, "We are going to look like such jerks when the tapes finally come out." Nixon had amazing strategic vision, both in politics but also in geopolitics. And believe it or not, it probably would have been 65 or 66, he wrote this article for Foreign Affairs magazine called Asia After Vietnam, looking past the Vietnam War and telling Americans and the foreign policy establishment that there was this revolution going on in places like Singapore and Japan and Indonesia, where the third world peons were being educated and allowed to have the freedom to build and devise these new circuits for these things called computers, and that someday this revolution was going to change the rim of Asia, and America's duty was to just buy time for this to happen because it would happen. And so he, you know, very accurately predicted a lot of the changes that would happen in the world. So he did have that vision, and I think that the vision of China was his. It wasn't as dreamy as it's made out to be, because at that time, believe it or not, the Soviet Union and Red China were about to go to war over this river in the middle of nowhere in Siberia. Soviet Union had amassed more tank divisions facing China than facing Germany. There was at least one feeler from the Soviet government to the United States that if we take out the Chinese atomic bomb factories, will you support us in a war on China? And Nixon said, you know, no way. And instead, he played the triangular diplomacy the other way, and he exploited that rift. Did a great thing in just, you know, as you can, you know, bringing China into the world, triggering the massive changes that we've seen in China, but also, you know, really putting that first big crack in monolithic communism and moving us towards peace and perhaps in some ways setting up the Soviet Union for its eventual downfall.
Thank you.
Yeah. Kissinger was a great tactician, and he's also a great author. He's a better writer. His memoirs are wonderful, and so his memoirs about the China trip are much more poetic than Nixon's, which will cement Kissinger's place in history just by that. Yeah. Yes, sir.
Thank you. I'm really looking forward to reading the book. I've been interested in this guy since college. I actually got kicked out of a bookstore because I asked for the Nixon books.
Oh.
but here's what I want to ask you. I'm going to ask you two quick questions, and then I'll let you answer them. The first one is, what are the lessons from the Nixon experience that, if you had the chance, you'd want to impart to Donald Trump? If you had a chance to say, look, here's what happened, here's how you can avoid it, here's what you need to know.
Can I answer it quickly? Because I'll lose my train of thought.
Go. Yeah, I'm your age. I understand.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Yeah.
Now I have to remember my second.
Okay. unfortunately, I mean, people ask me about Nixon and Watergate and Trump and Russiagate, and unfortunately, the advice that I think Nixon would give Trump is to fire a lot of his aides and put in more professionals. I mean, the smartest thing that Trump could do right now is pay James Baker, whatever, or a person like James Baker, to come in and run a professional White House. There's no reason why Donald Trump cannot surprise us all and become Ronald Reagan and have a successful first term still.
Yeah.
Because I think he's surrounded by incompetents that are afraid to tell him no. Not that there were a lot of brave White House aides that ever tell presidents no, but they can give strong advice. So that would be his advice to Trump. But unfortunately, maybe for the same reason that Nixon couldn't do a wholesale house cleaning during Watergate, maybe Trump can't do that kind of house cleaning now, because all these guys were with him through the Russian stuff, through the campaign. And, you know, if he starts firing them or does a house cleaning, then they don't have any loyalty to him anymore. And I will tell you that, having studied the behavior of White House aides throughout Watergate, these guys are behaving now like they're covering something up. Duh, right? I mean, so it doesn't take a lot to suspect that they might be guilty. And that may stop Trump from doing what I think would have been Nixon's great advice. So the second question.
All right, the second question is, you described Nixon as pretty calculating, always thinking about what he did, very methodical, never spontaneous. If you had to kind of say what Nixon's core values were, what would they be? And was there times in history when he acted not calculatingly, but on the basis of those values, and you really saw what the man believed in, and that affected what he did?
Yeah, I think that sadly Nixon's core value was Nixon. He was such. I mean, American history is filled with Horatio Alger stories, but this guy really did it all by himself. And I think that expediency always won out. But besides that, he had this strange parental division in which the father was a madman, uneducated, managed to not be able to grow lemons in the world's most bountiful citrus county, and his mother, who was a devout... Now, Los Angeles, Southern California Quakers are not quite like Eastern Quakers. They're not quite so pacifistic. They're more like Protestants. They have steeples on their churches and such. Still, that Protestant, that Quaker feeling of peace and justice was bred into him. There were times, and not just by his mother. It was a big, that side of the family was important to him. So he always had those two sides warring to him. And as long as his mother was alive, I think it governed his behavior. And I still think that his great goal was to be able to come to her someday and say, look, mother, look what I've accomplished. I brought peace to the world. And so that was maybe the second most important thing guiding him. But the third would have been just his father's ferocity. And between the expediency and the ferocity, more than often than not, they overcame sort of the better impulses that he had.
Congratulations, Jack.
Thank you, sir. This is Holy Redeemer Cub Scout, Jack.
That's right. Where's little Johnny? I'm going to shift gears a little bit.
Sure.
First of all, struck by a comment in the Washington Post review about how Nixon books could go from the floor to the ceiling, and then your little anecdote about him pounding on the arm of the chair and saying what he said, but you didn't include that in the book, and then just thinking about all the new sources that you've discovered. So could you talk a little bit about the writing process,
sure.
How you attacked all of this to come up with this book, recognizing so much had come before you?
Yeah, good question. Above all, I wanted this book to be on the tables at Costco. I want this to be on beach blankets, and I especially wanted it to be in the hands of millennials. So my limit was 600 pages, and there are editors in this room who know that I don't clear my throat at 600 pages. but that was a self-imposed limit because I wanted this book to be readable, and I worked very hard to try to make it readable. But that left a lot of, you know, and particularly when you're a journalist who moves into the scholarly field, the academic field, you're going to get criticized if you have a double burden to have those sources and those deep thoughts and analysis too. So there's a second book, and the narrative stops with Dick being buried back in Yorba Linda at page 550, and then there's another 120 pages of notes, and inside some of those notes are little stories about what was the CIA's role in Watergate? Who authorized the Watergate break-in? You know, little controversies of history that I felt needed to be addressed, and I had an editor, fortunately, who liked that kind of stuff, and so we did it. And when I went on Brian Lamb, who's still doing book notes for C-SPAN, and he's a junkie, and he asked me an hour of questions and never got out of the notes. Never got to the narrative whatsoever. So that was the way I handled it. And it was, in some ways, I blundered into it because it wasn't like a deep strategic thought. It was just that whenever I came to something that seemed like it was going to bog the flow of the story down, I stuck it in the back. And so there's two books there. There's one for the general reader, and there's one for somebody who wants to go in more and chew on it. So
sort of like the appendix of a government report.
That's right. So thank you very much. Okay. I'm sorry.
Very, very brief question, sir.
Sure.
You alluded in your remarks earlier that you felt that Nixon probably won the 1960 election, the popular vote. Could you explain your statement?
Yeah, believe it or not, the 1960 election, we don't know who won the popular vote. It's because every state counted the votes, except for Alabama, which didn't count Democrats and Republicans or Nixon and Kennedy. They counted only the votes for electors, and some of the electors in Alabama on the Democratic side were certified by the Democratic Party, and some were running as Dixiecrats with Strom Thurmond. So it was this total mess, and it didn't matter, depending on how you count the votes in Alabama, Nixon or Kennedy could have won the popular vote of the election. So,
right. Thanks.
It's a footnote.
It's a footnote.
Okay. We have books for sale behind the pastor. This year's up front.
Yes, ma'am.
Best writers and top thinkers. Live at Politics and Prose is a co-production of The Bookstore and Slate.com. For information about upcoming Politics and Prose events, visit politics-prose.com. And please let us know what you think of this program. Our email is podcasts at slate.com.